So I'll say IOS, and that means Institute of Ocean Sciences. That program had sort of a contract person on that actually did the work on the cruise out to Ocean Station Papa and back. And finally, William J. Stewart, which until recently was a sort of a hotel at Euclid, that was pretty much devoted to hydrographic surveys. And hydrography was pretty much dominant at that time in this area. So, so what happened to make things go forward? There's about four factors that I could identify. One is a make or buy policy, and I'm going to talk about that in a moment. But briefly, it says that this is in the late 60s. It was government policy that goods and services were practicable shall be contracted out. Secondly, there was a contract ship called the Laymore, and the federal government was spending about $300,000 a year contracting for that ship. And that was laid up, and the money was diverted to contracting out, basically. And to keep it in perspective, at that time, the budget for what is now IOS was about $5 million, so it was about 10% or so. So that was a pretty significant amount. And thirdly, I'll talk about the creation of the Marine Technology Center, which is on just quite near Institute of Ocean Sciences across the street, as sort of a counterexample. And fourthly, and most importantly, is the unsolicited proposals program. So I'll talk about some of those. So the make or buy. So the idea of floating around was that maybe an institute was needed in this area to sort of consolidate efforts and make things go. So there was a big study that went for a couple of years with the conclusions out in about 1972. And there's three reasons why you might want to have an institute, an ocean institute. One is fisheries, but we have a perfectly adequate one up in Nanaimo, Pacific Biological Station. The second one was pollution, but that's sort of local effects, and that wasn't consistent with really the thinking of the day. But the third big one, it was global climate change. So even then, in the late 60s, it was known that you know, CO2 was going to be a problem. And so that was the reason for these ocean sciences. And a fellow from UBC, Dr. Bob Stewart, was basically selected to be the leader of the pack, the director general actually at the time of the nascent Institute of Ocean Sciences. And then the other conclusions that came out of this make or buy study was if it's going to be a single building to house everyone, then they were going to cap the number of people there. And that was an important decision. So it was capped to about 300 people. And from time to time, you know, people being what they are, the numbers would creep up to about, you know, 330 or so, and then there'd be a little bit of pruning annually.
Pruning.
and also with make or buy, yes, the majority of science was to be contracted out. And then there's a big battle about where would it be, this institute, because we already had a couple people, not very many, but a couple at Defense Research Establishment Pacific, which no longer exists, but it was a major factor in the area at the time. It was on, so it was on the military base at Esquimalt. And there was people that really liked being there or associated with the post office in Victoria. And they liked the idea of being able to go shopping at noon, which the other alternative was out here on the peninsula somewhere. And there was a group that also wanted that, so you had those two, a little bit of a tug of war. But finally, the decision was to place it at Pat Bay, Patricia Bay. And then the other final thing that came out of the Maker Buy was the need to, if you're going to have that, then you should have an associated building for industry called the Marine Technology Center, and that to be constructed just after IOS. So in the period 73 to 80, a group called Ocean Chemistry was created, focusing on the CO2 measurements. It was based in Victoria under the Dragon Street Bridge. And so it was focused on carbon dioxide. Second thing was industrial liaison officer was, position was created. Initially that was a fellow by the name of Bob Smith. And then after that was another guy called John Watt, who was sort of my boss. At that time, the industrial liaison officer was blended into sort of an engineering services type of thing. So it was an interesting dynamic in that there was an in-house group that sort of built things, but that same, the guy in charge was also responsible for contracting others. And that was probably important, because you can sort of call traffic. And in about 1980, I assumed that same position. So, and then still in the 73 to 80 period, people, gradually more and more people relocated to the Saanich Peninsula, because a lot of this was pretty agricultural, pretty rural at the time. And there was a few dominant companies. DeBrocky SeaTech was one. Seachem Oceanography was another one, which is part of Access now. And another one was Arctic Sciences, which is now ASL Environmental Sciences. And that speaker was January. And the interesting thing about that was that the companies, by and large, weren't separate. They were on the site, mixed in with government. And that's again an important point. So now we talk about the Marine Technology Center, which was built from 78 to 80. And for me, this is a case study in how not to develop industry. It was all federal land across the airport. There were about 50 acres of it, and 5 acres of that was hived off for this Marine Technology Center. So it was federal land. The building was designed and erected by the province of BC, and it was intended to rent space to industry. So it was a terrible design. Some people here I know work in that building, and it was designed, it was strange for an incubator facility to be designed not to incubate. It was organized in bays, and so there's no way you could get from one place to another without going outside at the time. And when it would rain, you'd have water running down the second floor things, and so you'd have to walk along the edges. So the cure for that is they put in a wooden walkway, which became just greased and so then they carpeted that wooden walkway. And finally we have it today. They enclosed it and that sort of works. but it was actually designed to be a quadrangle, so four sides to it. But the only thing that was ever built was the first wing of that. And the other thing was that it had very expensive plumbing, glass plumbing in it. Like all the sewage on that side gets pumped across the inlet, or across the peninsula in some way, and discharged over on this side. That was one of the conditions to sort of preserve the North Saanich environment there. And finally, it was jointly managed by the feds and the province. And what a nightmare. So by the time it was ready for occupancy, the proposed rents had skyrocketed. The key tenant, namely Seachem, had said, I'm out of here. Yeah, and so They went together with another company, Applied Microsystems, to develop a piece of property that was over here on some vacant land. And ASL put up their building at the corner of Mills McDonald Park Roads, and Terra Remote Sensing came along a little bit later than that. And so in some sense, this is a backward success. But by erecting that building, they made it, some people stayed in there, namely DeBrocky SeaTac, but most people were forced to into their own buildings. And actually both approaches worked. So in about 2000, I guess, and jumping ahead, the Marine Technology Center was transferred to UVic under some arrangement. I'm sort of not familiar with the details on that. So that's where that is. But the fourth factor, now, the most important program was the unsolicited proposals program. This is a national program. The way the federal government works, they vote money, and it needs to be spent in that year. And things being what they will, not everything gets spent. And so there's a little bit of extra money. And somehow the Department of Supply and Services at the time was able to grab about 20 million of that as an unsolicited proposals program and put that up for contracting. And IOS, as I mentioned earlier, we had 300 grand of money that used to go to Laymore or ship contracting. And I guess ideally it was supposed to continue to go to ship contracting, but I was able to just use it for contracting and nothing to do with ships. So that helped. So what we were able to do is, there's sort of three major conditions for the unsolicited proposals program to allow a company to win a contract, win, I guess, in quotes, because there were sole source contracts. One was scientific merit, you know. Secondly was technical feasibility, had to be able to be done. And thirdly, it was uniqueness. And we played games with this, but there was never any complaints. And so the net result was to get the scientific merit, a scientist would say, well, look, I've got a dollar. I can get a dollar from the industrial liaison officer, and then I can get $4 from the unsolicited proposals program. So that's one-sixth, and two-thirds. And so the company would see a fully funded contract. Now, I don't know how familiar people are with scientists, but they're pretty demanding sorts. And so they had super high expectations and not much money. But they figured, you know, well, if I only have to put one-sixth of the money up, you know, that allays my concerns about the risk. And so they were pretty much forced to deal with companies. And so that was a great thing to have. The other important thing, I don't know how this happened, but we were able to do multi-year contracts. So oftentimes, if you want to do something significant, it takes 3 years. So that meant that there was a lot of risk-taking on the government side. It meant that they had to bet that they were going to have money available 1, 2, or 3 years downstream. And, you know, they're allocating money they didn't have. But everybody wanted it. So the net result is this UP program forced a collaboration between government and industry. And what I found is I had to sort of wander around about every 2 months just to show my face. Because if I let it go longer than that, things would go off track and there'd be big problems. But if you just show up, people, you know, it wasn't too frequent that you weren't disturbing companies too much. And that was sort of a good thing. There was always technical problems. scientists were just ruthless in what they had contracted for. You know, and it's just their nature, you know, they're driving towards their goal, and we're just along for the ride. And so they would push the companies to you know, really develop their skills. And, you know, in hindsight, that was probably a good thing, but it was tough on the companies, I know that for sure. And the other thing is that on the financial side, companies would perhaps go over budget, and up to about 20% overrun, they would just swallow it. You know, it was easier to do that than to ask for a change to the contract. So, and then on our side, you know, we're juggling, you know, 20, 30 contracts, and budgets are awarded on an annual basis. There's no real mechanism to extend them. But to credit to everybody that, you know, it wasn't just the Institute of Ocean Sciences. There was lots of other departments and agencies and so on cooperating to make this happen. And they all played along, so they would juggle their budgets to accommodate this. So the niche that was being developed was sort of like the environmental niche. And you'd really notice this when you went to a conference. The companies from this little corner of the world would really stand out as having sort of super skills. So through the 80s, many companies formed and thrived. I would go around every couple of years and do a survey to find out how many people they have in different various categories: scientists, engineers, and programmers, technicians, marketing, that sort of thing. Also, I'd ask for their gross sales, and most companies would share with me their gross sales, providing I aggregated those numbers and never ever let them out. And I've been so good about that now I don't have those individual numbers. And the staggering thing was, like I have here in 74, we were doing 100 grand in sales. And by 1992, we were doing 18.7 million in sales. So there was times in the early 80s where the doubling rate was 2 years, which if you do the rule of 72, it's 36% growth rate year over year, aggregate. And it was just staggering. And that can't continue because you just can't put the management controls in place to manage that. So it was like trying to manage an avalanche.
If I could just reemphasize this time, that is now considered the nexus and the core of today's Lower Vancouver Island technology industry. It was these 30 or 40 companies that were formed from that program, with Terry helping manage the program and those things. And it was those companies that became really big companies that allowed the industry to form. And it's worth just reflecting on what a fascinating time that was.
Oh, it was.
And where it's come and where it's come to now.
Yeah, well, the key concept is exponential growth. You know, that's something that's not easily understood. It means that not much happens for a long time. But you know, the exponential process is working, and then gradually it just takes off like that. And if you're an engineer and you plot it on a semi-log graph, it's a straight line, so you can actually guess what's going to happen. But it's just not obvious early on. That's what like 5% or 35% growth rate means. That's exponential growth. And so that's what we were seeing in the absence of any constraints, basically. There was enough money floating around, there was enough smart people floating around, and there was a will to make something happen that allowed that to happen. One of the things that happened was mixing. So we tried to organize events at the Institute of Sciences so that companies would come in voluntarily and participate in some sort of funding mechanism or technical talk or something like that every few months. And so that mixed things. One example was Tom Sittenday. He was a Deputy Minister of Fisheries and Oceans. And we used the IOS building. Companies came in and occupied little booths and then he actually visited every little booth. And so there was an intense focus on companies just to show them what was going on. And then the other thing was we had to police it internally. And this is something the industry wouldn't normally know, but we had a contract review panel, yeah, because scientists really would prefer to have people working directly for them. And this is, I mean, it's true to this day. And so they would try various ways to hire somebody in, so contract in. In other words, basically subvert the salary cap or the staffing caps. And so we formed a little contract review panel, so every contract that was going out was vetted. That sort of saved, you know, solved that problem. Then there's a few things that happened along the way. In 1982, the Debrocky Sea Tank went supernova, and so they went bust. But the interesting thing you learn about that is that the people didn't actually go away. You know, the entity called Debrocky Sea Tank did, but it generally the people went and specialized in some other different areas, formed several companies. And I see some people around here that benefited from that. The other thing that happened in 1980, at least according to my records, is the first engineer got hired. And that marked a turning point, because that weathership program that I mentioned early on that developed some skills in the contract community to do science, deploying CTDs, the conductivity temperature depth probes. Those skills had been developed through the late 70s. And then at that point, there was sufficient expertise that companies felt comfortable starting to build things themselves. And so that's what happened there. And once you hire an engineer, you end up with hiring more technicians, and then you have to hire marketing folks, and the thing just takes off. So that's how that sort of mix works. Then 1984 came the, anybody remember the scientific research tax credits?
Oh, yeah.
another disaster by and large.
Whoa, there's some consultants down the corner there. Terrible.
Yeah. Aren't they still looking for Frank Hurtel?
Oh, wow, that's old.
Yeah. So companies I'd never heard of came into existence and something coming and calling me. It certainly overheated the sector for a while, although some companies really benefited from that. And you know, you see some like LGL have quite a nice building, I think, in part due to that. So worthy companies actually did okay, and then some of the other companies just went and disappeared. And then in '86, Internet Computing went supernova as well. That was a software company, once again, you know, the company split into about five different pieces. People tend to stay in the area, and one company that may talk or he has talked recently is Bill with Quester Tangent. So they're now in sort of black boxes for trains, but their origin was with the marine sciences community.
I think that's an important point to mention, Terry, is a lot of the companies that started with oceanographic products or affiliations and have then taken their technology into whole different areas.
Yeah.
And that's why we're actually seeing a lot of really fine technology companies
yeah.
That are not doing ocean products anymore.
Yeah, and if I have a point, that's the point.
Yeah.
Yep, thank you. So by the late 80s, the Industrial Liaison Officer Fund had decreased from the 300 grand down to about 50 grand, just chipping away. In 89, FIATECH was founded by Colin Lennox, and had a broader mandate than the marine sciences focus. In 1990, I woke up one morning and the UP program was gone. Just and that was quite a shock. So and through the 90s, there was cutbacks to IOS, both in staff and budgets, and companies started to reorient to other clients. We still had small contracts, but now you had, oftentimes it was 50-50 cost sharing. So gone were the days where you could have a fully funded contract, including profit. Now you had to, companies had to come up with 50%. And for some small companies, that's pretty much a killer. You just can't do that. And so unfortunately, that's the way it is today. And in 92, that's when the Sydney Breakfast Club was founded. And I think Dave, when he talked, talked about some of the motivation behind that. But basically, it was an attempt to get industry to industry working in collaboration, a little bit of government, it's to its credit, it's still going strong 25 years later. So in the 90s and 2000s, we picked a few projects to promote, like with Terra Remote Sensing, the LIDAR program, and with ASL Environmental Sciences, the Acoustic Scintillation Program. We sort of helped out with EduTech. I don't know if people remember that. So the students brought into, we had a big event at the what is now Mary Winspear Center, and sort of a trade fair, but no one was selling anything. Companies just showed up to demonstrate to the local community what was going on, because by and large, industry sales were global, not really even domestic. And so to make that aware. And then something that's important, in 2007, five of the scientists at IOS were participants in that Nobel Prize for associated with global warming and so on. So, two last things, some takeaways, and here's it. If the government policy goal is to develop industry, then I have a few points to make. Number one is make cheap surface land, and this applies to municipal governments as well as federal, although my experience has been federal, is make cheap surface land available. Secondly, create a place where the founders want to live. So that's everything from quality of life to everything else. Identify complementary roles for government and industry. And have a mechanism for close intermingling, like the Sydney Breakfast Club, for instance. That's the role it plays. And focus on the skills. So it's not so much the products that are coming out of companies, it's the skills that are involved to make that happen. And then in terms of technology transfer, I have some things that never work, sometimes work, and always work. And what never works is a tail end technology transfer. By that I mean a place like IOS develops a product fully formed and says, okay, who wants to license it? Doomed to failure every time. One of the things I encountered was Canada Patents and Development Limited, which doesn't exist anymore, I don't think. And it's the repository for all the patents in the country. And when I looked at the balance sheet, the amount of revenue they got just about covered the salaries that were required to run that operation. So it was a waste. In the fullness of time, it got closed down. The other thing that doesn't work is contracting with no intimate knowledge. One of the factors with IOS was there was a principle called core expertise. So there's a little bit of contracting in, development inside, and a lot of contracting for similar work outside. And that meant that the people doing the contracting, you know, basically both knew what they were talking about. Because if you don't have that, then you end up contracting for garbage. Sometimes works is a partition development, so you can put some inside workers, government, together with some industry, with some clearly defined split, like maybe it's hardware and software, or some other partitioning, and then you develop the stuff together. And then the more recent contracts, the rights of a contract revert to the industry side of things, so there's no secondary transfer to industry of the rights. And then another thing that can work too is you can sort of do some sort of proof of concept inside, but early on in development, move that to industry. So I call that a fooling and realm stage. But what always works is encouraging trained people to leave the fence.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, and that's pretty reliable. Speaking personally. So, in conclusion, I'd say this is a very successful government initiative, helped develop an industry and create an economic development. At one time, one reporter called this the Blue Water Silicon Valley. So, and industry today, as Bill mentioned, has migrated away from the iOS roots. There's something lost.
Yeah, something gained too.
Like in the early 90s, when that UP shock hit, companies, you know, grew up almost overnight. You know, and I don't think many people failed, but they certainly had to reorient away from their major client, and you know, maybe that was right. You know, since that time, like computers are becoming much more important, communications in this whole area. Electronic communications, it's a different focus than just the marine sciences. So it was probably time to leave the nest. And so that's it.
Wow.
Thank you, Terry. It's really tough to sort of cram all that early history into a little bit. And there was a lot that happened because of that and following that as well. One of the government programs probably that was really influential, and I'm not sure exactly when it started, was the IRAP program.
I meant to mention that throughout this, there's, when I mentioned people coming in, we would have close interactions with IRAP, and some of the presentations to industry were the IRAP.
Yeah,
I'm sorry I missed that. Yeah.
Well, that's fine. And the reason I had sort of thought about that is that one of the companies I was working with when I was back in Ontario, we actually took some early technology from National Research Council in Ottawa and commercialized it into products. And in fact, those products, then part of them were sold and used out here at iOS and some of the other institutes for the CTDs, for example. Mm-hmm. So it was a really interesting time. And the other point I'd just like to sort of add on to what Terry was talking about of this exponential growth. One of the things that between the Breakfast Club and Viatech and the industry as a whole is that we'd all been moving towards what is called critical mass in the industry. And that's where the industry can actually support itself, where we've got bankers involved, we've got lawyers involved, we've got intellectual property involved, so that a company that's growing up in the tech sector is fully supported by the other services within our community. And we look at the numbers Terry gave in the early days. You know, I'm not sure what we're doing now generally in the Greater Victoria area, but it's a number of billions of dollars coming out of the tech sector. And it hasn't been that long since we actually hit critical mass in the industry. So it's really, it's important to remember the startups and how it happened and why it happened. So thank you very much, Terry. Questions?
Does the current operating model contemplate anything of a historical nature, like 50-50 kind of individual contribution, that kind of thing?
I think 50-50 funding or is probably pretty standard now. And, you know, the people involved with these Ocean Times have all sort of changed now. And so that culture of contracting out, which was, you know, never scientists' first preference, that's sort of not strong at all. Yeah, but, and I think it would be better if it were, but that's the way it is. Nick?
You were mentioning that one of the models that didn't work was essentially developing something in-house and then sort of allowing it to become without private industry. It just doesn't work.
Yeah. Ego. Yes. No, it's not invented here. You know, what you did, we went through this a few times with a program called PILP under the IRAP program, despite best intentions, what would happen would people would take a fully developed from the scientist's point of view item. Place it with industry, and industry would just change it all around. And it was to do with that buy-in. It's like when you get served your meal at in a restaurant, you just turn the plate a bit, and that's your ego kicking in. You know, you're asserting ownership over that, and that's at the heart of it. But in a word, ego.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Terry, as someone who obviously was very much involved in the early days of work with iOS and someone who's still sticking to the roots of work in the ocean sector. I've seen iOS go through a period of kind of obscurantism in the last days, in the last years, possibly now a resurgence in funding for government science. To me, iOS was always very much like a catalyst. It was a great place to go, bounce off ideas, get projects going and so on. Are you optimistic in seeing that place across the road becoming again this type of thing?
I don't know. I you know, I'm now separate from iOS, and there's no reason why it couldn't. But there is a lot of money floating around right now related to the Ocean Protection Plan and things like that, that could be directed. But you know, there's nobody doing that direction. The other thing that happened in the sort of late 80s is iOS was divided up into pieces. And until about 87 or so, there was a director general in charge of that institute, and it was like a city state. And so all the decisions associated with that building were made ultimately by one person there. And that was very helpful. But that's not the model that the decision makers in Ottawa like, and so the ships got split off, the hydrographic service got split off, the ocean sciences got split off in a couple different ways. So it sort of lost its focus.
It's hard if the government at some stage has gone through this, doesn't really believe in science, And I have a big problem with that, because I think places like iOS and the National Research Council, I mean, their job is research and building some of those liaisons with industry. And industry's job is to be able to a large extent, pick and choose some of that technology and figure out how to make money with it and sell it to the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And that's where we should be going. I don't think there's a perfect model at all, but the government has had some real successes, and then they somehow decide that they're going to try something different and forget the successes, which is unfortunate.
Maybe the last question.
So during the 90s, I was like 7 or 8 years old. And I'm a tad bit confused about the growth of the industry through your activities and the growth of Viatech and that merging, and then I think in the 2000s that sort of separation, frankly. Can you talk a little bit about that, and maybe that's even for your talk next time, but
yeah,
because I see the Viatech buffet, and in fact it isn't.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
and worth talking about why that, you know. Yeah. Anyway, there you go.
Well, just at the time, we were sort of, you know, like by 1990 and 92, I guess, you know, we were being forced to away from industry almost.
Yeah.
And we had it sort of, and that was just cut. So, you know, we had our heads down pretty much. And but Viatech was starting to spread. And like I mentioned, you know, the influence of the computer and the internet was percolating through the area here, and Viatech had a much broader focus of industry. Mm-hmm. So whereas ours was a pretty narrow niche on marine science and technology,
yeah,
companies. So it was a natural transition, actually, fortuitous, in fact.
Mm. Yeah. And for those of you, because it has been a little bit confusing, we have the Sydney Breakfast Club. The Sydney Breakfast Club has basically been a very informal business networking group where we could sit down in the early days, and still do to a large extent, talk to one another about issues around our business. And you know, our sectors were overlapping. We had ocean sectors, we had software sectors, we had manufacturing sectors, in all sorts of areas. And so the Breakfast Club has sort of tried to maintain that networking, maintain that transfer of information on the business side of technology. Viatech as an entity, as Terry had said, was really, it's an industry association, and the companies involved in that industry association are working in all different sectors. And their job at that point was basically to make sure that interaction happened, and it was supported. It was to try to draw in those other services that I talked about as well, on the consulting side, the, you know, the law side, the intellectual property side, and the financing side. And so it has a different role, but you require an industry association that is supportive to actually help and industry stay together and grow. And the point that Terry made, and is probably worth mentioning, is that the industry, the technology sector in general, whether it be the ocean side or focused on any other area, on Vancouver Island, its markets are international. You do not sell locally. There is not enough people buying products in the local area to support companies, at least not a technology tech company. So you really have a different focus on how you support it. You, what we have here with iOS and other companies is starting up that technology, transferring people, getting people moving around with that knowledge transfer. But the products themselves that are being developed are being sold in the States and Europe and Asia, all over the place. But we have a really strong industry here, and a lot of that was because of the early work that iOS did. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Bill. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Anyway.